Hey, what's up, guys? On this episode of Drugs and Stuff, we've got drugs in the news, and Victoria Felkar joins us to talk about this huge Olympic weightlifting scandal that's going on. After that, we do listener questions. We talk a little bit about raloxifene. How beneficial is that compared to other SERMs? We talk about trend in the off season, and we talk about our top three favorite supplements that we've got to have in the house at all times. We're going to do all that right here, right now on Drugs and Stuff. Welcome back to Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland. I'm Scott McNally. Our programming is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You could use our code ADVICES for some additional savings. Also brought to you by GetAzoth.com. We've got links for all that stuff down in the description. David Crossland, we've got a big show today. We have a segment. This was actually suggested to us by one of our listeners. We have a new Drugs in the News. So here's the deal. I want to first give out a shout out to Sean. He's one of our listeners. He said, hey, I thought this would be a great segment. I'm looking at the ESPN article right now. The title is Weightlifting Investigation Finds Hidden Positive Doping Tests, Millions in Missing Money. An investigation of the International Federation, Weightlifting Federation has found doping cover-ups and millions in missing money, lead investigator Richard McLaren said Thursday. He's out of Canada. McLaren said 40 positive doping tests were hidden in IWF records, and the athletes whose cases were delayed or covered up went on to win medals in the world championships and other events. Now, this goes deep, Dave. There's so much to this. McLaren said former IWF president Thomas Agin was an autocratic leader who kept the board in the dark about finances and left officials fearing reprisals if they spoke out. He received cash payments on behalf of the IWF as doping fines from national federations or sponsors. What are we seeing here? Okay, so McLaren said 10.4 million dollars, Dave. Can you believe that? $10.4 million was unaccounted for, and the analysis of cash going in and out. On top of that, it says the largest fine recorded was $500,000 paid by is this an African country, Azerbaijan? Am I saying that right, Dave?
You're saying it right. I think it's an African country. Okay. Yeah.
It's unclear how the payment was made.
No, that's Eastern Bloc.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. It's unclear how payment was made. On one trip to Thailand for a competition and conference, Agin collected more than $440,000 across 18 payments, according to the report. Basically, he was telling people that they had to pay if they wanted to be considered part of the Olympics.
From what I understand, there was a story of four officials, each carrying $25,000 in a briefcase, traveling across in a car to deliver him his fine in cash.
Yeah, he required cash. What? They did not get a receipt. They did get a receipt.
Would you, as a country, as official representation of a country's Olympic team, not question why a fine was to be delivered in cash?
Listen, though, here's the deal. I feel like this guy had a stronghold. It says in one of the other articles I was reading that he was paying officials. He was bribing people to vote for him and his cronies. So he had a stronghold on the Federation. He was there since 1976. There was no getting him out. And so you either played ball with him, gave him the money, or you just weren't part of the Olympics.
But if I was representing the British Olympic weightlifting team.
Yeah.
And I got told that I had to deliver a $200,000 fine in cash.
Yeah.
I would be going to the Olympic Committee and going, is this right? Should I be delivering this in cash? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you'd question it straight away, wouldn't you? But, yeah, I mean, he from what I understand of the article, he paid bribes from $5,000 to $30,000 to get votes from officials. And he also took bribes to hold back on revealing of failed drug tests so that people could still compete. And I think they found an email, didn't they, from a country thanking him for not exposing the drug failures.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I spoke to Victoria last night about this, and she had some interesting insight. I'm going to bring her on. We figured that she would be able to shed some more light on this. Let me see if I can connect to her now. All right, Victoria, I'll have you stay just toward the middle of your screen there because we're all sharing one third of the screen. Perfect. How are you this morning?
I'm good.
Thank you for joining us. So Dave and I were just discussing this this article that came out, this whole debacle with Olympic weightlifting. And we thought it would be great to get your insight to understand a little bit more about Olympic weightlifting in general.
There's a lot. there's a lot. So I didn't know because I've been researching.
Right.
In depth. Scott filled me in on this yesterday. So I've been totally like not paying attention to anything but my work. So I knew that there was some things coming that would be coming up with weightlifting and doping, but I didn't know the extent of it until yesterday. But I think when I read some of the articles this morning, two separate things came out to me. So one being anti-doping cover-up, two being bribery payoffs,
yeah,
that aspect. So I think we can kind of think about it or look at it as two different corruptions happening, and each of them are really, really loaded. Each of them have their own histories within sport too. So when you think about corruption in the Olympics itself, and Olympics is just one like international sporting organization, it runs deep. I mean, corruption in terms of briberies, scandals, payoffs related to doping, and then other things too, from judges getting paid off to bribery in terms of like Salt Lake City, 1998, there was this big thing that people got paid to actually have the bid process. So in the bidding process, all of a sudden international representatives were having their kids sent to universities in the U.S. They were getting paid for to actually, you know, get that vote. So it's long and it's ongoing in terms of like the corruptions and bribery and everything else. And then doping also has its own nebulous of issues within the Olympics. And I think that it's easy because in recent memory, Russia scandal was huge. And I think a lot of the conversation around that was like, oh my goodness, Russia, bad doping. And now I feel like it's going to be, oh my goodness, weightlifting, bad doping. And that completely ignores everything else going on. Russia's not the only country that has doping. Weightlifting's not the only sport that has doping.
You have to be quite logical. If a country the size of Russia is going to run a statewide doping program, then that answers that if they're not winning every single event they enter by miles, considering the genetic pool that they have with the size of their population, that what is everybody else doing to be able to even be on the same playing field?
Absolutely. And I think when we think about the anti-doping movement is really complex. There's a lot of different aspects to it. So drug testing first started in officially in the Olympic movement in 1968. Anabolic steroids, though, they couldn't be tested for until 1976. And so it kind of was like from 1968 to 1976, we're trusting that you're not taking these, but we don't have the tests to be able to actually test for them. Kyram's around to 1976, they introduced testing, but the testing was so bad.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of false positives and everything else was rampant. And I would argue today, we still don't have perfect tests for anabolic androgenic steroids or for really any performance enhancing agent. So the system of the testing of anti-doping is flawed. But then when we just think about the ideas of anti-doping, that can be challenged too. From whether or not athletes should be allowed to dope, what is doping? Who's governing these organizations like WADA, like the IOC? So in one of the articles, McLaren had said I think it was McLaren that had said it about nobody's policing these organizations. Like when something goes wrong and you have these corruption and these scandals, who's policing? And that's, I mean, I used to teach a class on the Olympics, critical studies of the Olympics. And that was always my question to my students is that you have a country that, say, antagonizes another country, or they do something that is seen to be unlawful, unethical. The UN steps in and polices them. Now, if a sporting organization does that, who polices them?
Yeah.
So
they don't even have a policing over the medical exemptions, do they?
No, they don't. And I mean, that's, again, when we go into the thing about doping, it's like, it's so complicated because you can have medically exempt doping, essentially. You can also have what's called an anti-doping rule violation, or ADRV, for non-analytical reasons. So meaning that it wasn't a drug test for why you got this anti-doping violation, it's other reasons. So from associating with people that are doping to the actual officials themselves. So when you think about the big lists of, I mean, WADA puts them out every 2 years or so of like, here's the doping reports, the anti-doping reports. And they've got all these different ADRVs. They're not all for like positive tests. Not to mention, even when you start looking at that information for, I mean, the analytics on this, it's astounding. So 2017, bodybuilding was the top doped sport. Well, bodybuilding, I mean, the reason why it was because it was in the Pan Am Games. They're trying to get bodybuilding still in the Olympics to this day. So they were trying to get into through the Pan Am Games, high amount of doping offenses. But cycling was right there behind them. I mean, I think it was by like 10 or so violations. Track and field was there right there behind them. Weightlifting was way down. I think they were like number 6 of top doping violations. But now we have more insight on
depression. Now we know why.
Why that was.
And, you know, too, you mentioned yesterday while we were talking about this.
Yeah.
So this guy, this Tomas Adjan,
yeah.
He actually, so you said that we're reading he came into power in 1976.
Yeah.
And that's
which
also
the year
that you just said that they start testing. Yeah. Dave, I got to tell you, too, I don't know if you saw a picture of this guy. He looks like he's up to something no good. He looks like a bad man.
I was at a bit when he said if people didn't play ball, their athletes would test dirty.
No.
So he wasn't only covering up bad testing or dodgy testing. He was also literally creating false test results that were negative, that were positive for doping in order to blackmail a country into playing ball with him.
Yeah. And I think that issue is, I mean, that's wrong. But at the same time, how many athletes get canned with false positive results? Maybe it's not some corrupt overseer that's doing these, but when the testing itself is very flawed, when the ideologies behind the testing is very flawed, I think this scandal is just a micro blimp in kind of the corruption of anti-doping.
It's definitely a small window into what is a much bigger picture.
And
the fact that the doping scandals and the bribery scandals and the financial scandals involved in this one small segment are so blatant. I mean, you know, $10.3 million missing. It isn't like you've dropped some change down the back of your couch.
Oh, my God, that's so much money.
You know, that's a huge amount of money. Okay, it is over a long period of time, but that's still a huge amount of money. And the blatantness of this guy when he's saying that, you know, he's got emails saying, thank you for covering up our positive test till after the show. Or if they don't play ball, I'll mark their athletes as positive so none of them can compete. That is such blatant action that you've got to straight away start thinking, well, if he's doing it, what the hell are the rest of them doing?
Well, and if you look at a couple of the countries that were talked about, it's really interesting because it jogged my memory of a WADA report that came out a couple of years ago. And essentially they were looking at the breakdown of like all of the anti-doping rule violations. And then they subdivided it between like per country and per sport and then across different years. And so in 2004, I'm going to butcher the name because I've been Azerbaijan.
We just had that. You probably, I think she did better than I did. Okay. What do you think, Dave? So I think she did better than me.
In 2013, they only submitted 11 samples to WADA, and then in 2014, they submitted zero.
Nice.
Am I right in believing that Jamaica doesn't actually have a testing service in the country?
It's unclear where they're at with it. I tried to do some little bit of research into that. So 2014, I mean, Ukraine only submitted two samples.
I've actually interviewed a female athlete that said she was getting tested when she was pregnant.
Yeah.
On leave from competing.
Yeah.
To make up the numbers for the testing samples so that certain British athletes didn't have to be tested.
Yeah. Hmm. And that's the thing. You start looking at those numbers and it's so, I mean, it's so like Belgium is one of the top countries, top 10 countries for anti-doping rule violations. Belgium only has 11.5 million people. That doesn't make sense at all. And there's reasons for it, though. It's because of their vested interest in the anti-doping program. It's their criminalization of athletes. I mean, there is this really weird shift that happened in like the, in the 2010 onwards, where all of a sudden athletes caught doping were criminalized. So they were, even if what you got caught doing in sport was not illegal outside of sport, you were still viewed as a criminal for breaking a law, which just to me is mind-blowing.
Belgium is very much a cultural thing within the country. They very much have a cultural belief in this being done correctly, and it's very hard driven home and very well funded, and also got a huge amount of public support as well. Which is, like you say, why it doesn't stack in line with everybody else. But the thing is as well, Belgium's not really a country that you think of at the forefront of the Olympics.
No.
You know, it's not one of the big medal winners.
No, so, or even putting athletes in the games.
So if they're having such a high level of doping because they run stringent testing programs, that really to me is a bigger reflection of how far off other countries are. And how much they're hiding and covering up. Because we have a small country with a low athletic population, a low input into the games that's testing so highly, which sort of indicates how much everybody else is avoiding testing and managing testing.
Yeah, so just to give you an idea, so Belgium was 7% of like the anti-doping rule violations. India, with, you know, 1.3 billion people, is also 7%. China, with 1.3 billion or 1.4, is also 7%. Brazil was 10, US was 12, France was 15, and Italy came in first at 21.
Wow. Italy doesn't know what they're doing when it comes to covering shit up, I guess.
There's some reasons. There's some stringent eyes, especially after Tour de France and some of the doctors that got involved in that. Russia didn't even make it on the list.
They had enough money to pay
13,000 samples, but they still didn't make it on the list. But then now we know in hindsight the reasons for that.
Yeah. That's amazing.
And I think that it is such a complicated nebulous. I mean, even if you just look at how a drug can go from being prohibited to then allowed, or allowed to prohibited. Cannabis is a great example. It was not allowed, and now there's certain restrictions around it. Or drugs that are allowed for therapeutic use exemptions, others that aren't under any circumstance, which would be like testosterone. There's a very, very strict rules about the TUE for testosterone, very strict rules for it. However, it doesn't mean that athletes aren't using it. It just means that either it's getting covered up or it's getting done in a very smart way. There's lots of different methods of, you know, going around drug testing. Whether it's actually doctoring the tests, it's whether it's the paperwork that does, or it's actually the methods of application. So it would be stupid for us to think that anti-doping is as efficient and ethical.
To me, WAD has always presented it's always felt like it's a pacifier. Mm-hmm. It's an ineffective organization that is highly inefficient, that costs a fortune, and is only there for one reason and one reason only, to make the public thinking there's something being done.
It's a PR move by the Olympics.
Very much so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Victoria, we appreciate your time. It sounds like this is going to have some serious repercussions. I mean, this guy, he's no longer in charge. He retired. I guess he had enough. He had plenty of money, I'm sure, Dave.
He's 10.3 million that we know of. That's
right.
Only what's missing out of the accounts.
Right.
That's not the cash that's been coming through the door.
So he's good to go there. But I'm sure there's going to be some sort of legal charges brought against this guy.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah, this will be interesting. And I'm sure it's going to affect sports in the future. You know, this is not going to look good for weightlifting in the Olympics.
No, I just messaged a colleague of mine who is almost done or has done his PhD, and was doing it in the relationship of doping and weightlifting.
Ooh.
And some of the doctors over like the 60s and the 70s. And I just messaged him. I was like, so what are you thinking on this one? Because it remains unclear what's going to be done. Unfortunately, if we look at, for example, what happened with like Thailand Thailand, they weren't allowed to participate in Tokyo 2020 because of so many drug offenses, or Russia, not allowed to participate. And then it was interesting how that all happened and athletes ended up participating. But if the Olympic committee goes like, well, we're going to take weightlifting out of the Olympics, you know, to try to clean it up. But that doesn't, it's not the athletes that were responsible for the scandal. Obviously there's always going to be some bad apples in the eyes of the IOC and those that are caught doping, but it's really sad that that's typically what happens if a sport is deemed to be bad for publicity. It just gets yanked, and it's the athletes themselves that then see the repercussions of that. And that's not fair, but that's international sport.
But the athletes are following the culture of the environment in which they're operating, because effectively everybody's doing it. You've got to think, when you look back at John Ziegler development of drugs with Upjohn and everything else, and the fact that he coached the lifting teams.
Bob Hoffman, there's some great, great articles on either the StarkCenter.org, I think, or on LA84, which is a digital internet archive that highlight the entire history of doping in weightlifting. It's almost comical.
And yet they kick up this huge fuss about female athlete having a naturally high testosterone and insisting that she can't compete or she has to use hormone blockers.
Do you see the paper behind me on the floor? That's that.
Is it? That's genetics.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, that's your genetic advantage.
Yeah.
In the same way you've got long legs or what? No, it doesn't. And they hammer her when the whole, and this is a broad swathe statement, but the whole of the Olympics is corrupt.
Oh, yeah.
And what people don't, people think about doping, they think about steroids.
Yeah.
They think about performance drugs.
Yeah.
They don't think about beta blockers used by archers.
No. Antidepressants.
Yeah.
Or with my research, contraceptives.
Anything. Yeah.
Yeah. And that when you go back into, like, I was reading some stuff this morning on from like 1960, 1964, when they were trying to actually create the anti-doping commissions, and they were trying to define what doping was. They didn't come to a conclusion. But then suddenly 4 years later, we have the anti-doping testing. And these doctors from all over the world were fighting about, like, well, can we even test for these things? Should we even be testing for these things? Do we not expect athletes to be the, you know, the highest, jump the highest, run the fastest, be the strongest? Because if we are, then they need these. And I mean, those questions still remain today. It's sport, in my opinion, is inherently dirty. We are never going to clean it up, whether it's the people in charge, whether it is the, you know, ideas around what's an enhanced versus natural body, all the way to rules around the sports, how they're played, who's allowed to play them. It's inherently dirty. It's never going to be a level playing field, because sport in itself is not supposed to be a level playing field. You are supposed to have a winner. You are supposed to have a loser.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Well, we're out of time on this segment. We ran a little bit long here. Victoria, much appreciated. Thank you for coming on and
you're welcome.
Sharing some insight with us. And
as always, it was a pleasure.
We hope that your research continues to go well.
Going back down the rabbit hole.
All right, guys, we're going to go to a commercial break. We'll be back in just a minute.
Hey, what's up, guys? I want to jump in and take a brief pause to shout out our great sponsors. First of all, I want to give a big shout out to our new sponsor, Azoth. You guys can go to getazoth.com if you want to check them out. They have a few products in the lineup now, from Azoth 2.0 to Total Focus and Pure Energy, both of those containing a new ingredient, Zynamite. It's a mango leaf extract. It basically is working as a coffee and caffeine replacement. And what it does is it interferes with the breakdown of norepinephrine and dopamine. So meaning that will make other stimulants much stronger, but it will also help you to keep those feel good energetic hormones in your body for longer. So if you're interested in experimenting with nootropics and discovering the edge that they can give to you, then definitely check out getazoth.com, and we have the Amazon link in our show notes. Also, huge shout out to TrueNutrition.com. Thank you, True Nutrition, for supporting our podcast and for putting out high quality, third party tested supplements that we can depend on in the bodybuilding community. One of the things that I really believe about in True Nutrition is their pricing. Like I mentioned before, if you pay for 5 pounds of protein, first of all, it's just about wholesale prices. And then on top of that, you get 5 actual pounds of protein before they mix the flavoring in. That's something that you're not going to get if you go to a retail store. You'll get a tub, it has 5 pounds in it, and boom, that's it. This will be 5 pounds of protein plus the flavoring, comes out to about 6 pounds. So guys, definitely, they're a company that I have been involved with, a company that I have used, a company that I've suggested to my clients for a long time. They have tons of flavors, tons of different products. Check them out, TrueNutrition.com, and use our code ADVICES.
Guys, if you have any questions that you want to add to the live feed here, feel free. Feel free. I'm going to go to this one first. This is something I think, Dave, I doubt you've ever been able to fit your arm into a regular blood pressure cuff. I just have a feeling you might be able to fit like 2 small fingers into a blood pressure cuff. Question is, for you guys with 18 plus inch arms, what are you using for a blood pressure monitor? I've been using the wrist style, but I'm not sure if this thing is accurate. He says, I'm looking for one of these wireless arm ones, but the damn things are hard to find in stock. Do you even know what he's talking about, a wireless arm?
I'm assuming it's just a wireless with a pressure monitor on the sleeve, but I don't know how it would
be different than
pump up, unless there's a small pump built into it. The wrist ones are inaccurate. There's no way of denying that. Unfortunately, you can get some large arm cuffs, which would probably accommodate 18 inch. When you start going over the 20, and when you start getting into the really big numbers of arm size, you are looking at a thigh cuff.
At a thigh cuff, you said?
Yeah. Okay. The problem is that because a thigh cuff is designed to go around a leg, it doesn't fit the arm very well. And so, again, you're going to get some inaccuracies. I got that sick of medical practitioners not being able to take my blood pressure that I bought my own thigh cuff and used to take it with me.
Oh, really?
But we'd still have to do 2-3 readings and look at the average, because it is so easy for it to be thrown out because it's in an area where it just isn't designed to be.
Okay, yeah.
And as a result, it's not brilliant, but it's better than nothing at all. Mm. I have had a few nurses in the past that have done it the old-fashioned way, with the stethoscope and the watch and everything.
Okay, yeah.
I used a thigh cuff, and it would give me some form of measurement. But like I say, it could vary quite wildly. Yeah.
depending on, because the cuff's quite long.
Yeah.
So it does fit literally, you know, the whole section of your arm. And so it can be a little bit misplaced. And I think that one of the problems as well, that people tend to get cuffs that are too big as well, which is just as much of the problem as having a cuff that's too small.
Is it really? I didn't realize that.
Because they are designed to fit on a certain circumference.
Yeah, I found that for me, the large cuff works well. You know, that's my arm's never been as big as yours has, that it, you know, I haven't needed ever in my life. They never were like, bring the thigh cuff in. But if they ever try to do the small cuff, then my blood pressure just reads through the roof. Like it'll be like, you know, 170 over 110 or, you know, something 120, something like, it'll be crazy. And then they put the large cuff on and boom, I'm back down to normal. So, and I think no matter what you do too, just some basics on blood pressure monitors, whatever you do, your best bet is to take that cuff that you've purchased and take it into the doctor's office so that you can measure against their equipment. So if you do get, say he gets a larger cuff, I'm sure he'll be fine. He says 18 plus inch arms. He didn't say like 24 plus inch arms. If he gets a cuff for a larger arm, take it to your doctor's office. They'll test it because it may not be perfectly accurate, but you can compare it against the machine that they have that is accurate, and then you can kind of calibrate it from there and understand what your reading should be, right?
Yeah, but you tend to, when you're using abnormal size cuffs, you tend to have to sort of do 3 inches at the average because it does vary massively from each reading, unfortunately.
That makes sense. Yeah, that does make sense. And definitely those wrist cuffs are just terrible. I would not waste the money on one personally.
I've had some very spurious readings off them.
Yeah. All right, let's see here. Got a question for drugs and stuff. I've recently heard and looked into raloxifene. Of course, all I can see is how absolutely amazing it is for getting rid of gyno and fat in the nipple area without affecting estrogen whatsoever. How does this compare to Novadex? Is it really as good as it's portrayed to be? And what side effects are there, since I couldn't find any?
There aren't really. I mean, it's a similar sort of drug.
Okay.
Similar sort of actions. It's probably got slightly less of the negatives of Novadex. Long-term Novadex use can start to affect eyesight and stuff like that. One of the areas it blocks estrogen receptors is in the eyes.
Really?
Obviously, Novadex is an antagonistic and an agonistic estrogen blocker. So where it restricts estrogen at certain receptors, nipple being the main one, it increases estrogen activation in the liver.
Mm.
This is just really, I suppose, a second-gen version of that. It would be the best way of describing it.
Okay.
But it is difficult to get hold of. It's sourcing is a pain, which is why most people stick to Novadex, because it's the one that's commonly available.
I see it on all the research chem sites, you know, because people get it in, like, you know, bulk powder, then make their research chems and sell it that way. I've never seen it, like, for sale as a pharmaceutical.
No, it comes up now and again, but it is rare, mainly because there's not the demand for it. And you'll find that, I mean, as we've discussed in the past, you know, steroid uses has trends.
Yeah.
So drugs will become popular for a period of time. There was a period of time when Ment was really, really popular and DHB became really, really popular.
Yeah.
And then they settle back down into more normal usage. And certain drugs are sort of generally popular all the time, i.e. trends, one that's generally keeps its popularity quite stable.
D-ball.
Yeah, and as a result, these drug trends, excuse me, you'll find something like Floxen becomes very, very popular for a period of time, or Aromacin becomes very, very popular for a period of time, and then it will die away as people turn to other stuff.
Yeah.
But it's from a negative point of view, there's not really much in the way of negativity with SERMs in what we're going to experience as steroid users.
Okay.
Generally speaking, they're a relatively easy compound to get along with. People go on about Novadex affecting IGF-1.
Mm.
But in real world, you're talking out your ass, because the impact of anabolics on IGF-1 is going to far surpass any negative impact you're going to get from Novadex. But I mean, I know a lot of people that refuse to use a SERM because of the impact on IGF-1, and then they were bitching about having gyno and having to use letrozole to try and get everyone. Yeah. Shouldn't have been a dumbass in the first place, should you? You know, and you find this with users that they'll tend to micromanage drugs and look at the finites of a drug, when in fact you've got to take sometimes a bit more of a holistic approach and look at it as a general overview.
Okay.
In the real world, you do not have concerns from lowered IGF-1 from running a SERM.
Okay.
It's just going to have no impact on your physical development at all. And the fact that something can affect something in that way doesn't necessarily mean it's going to have an overall impact in you.
Yeah, yeah.
Fun.
Well, when you talk about side effects too, I mean, realistically, this isn't something that you're going to be running. Like, you know, people say, for instance, talk about the side effects of Arimidex, that, you know, it may affect cholesterol more than Aromacin. So Aromacin, you can run that, you know, without having as strong of an effect on cholesterol. Now, okay, that makes sense, because you're going to use that potentially long term through your TRT year round, but there's no real reason to use Novadex or Raloxifene year round, right? You know, this is something that you would use in an as needed situation, wouldn't you?
More so, yeah. I mean, I like Novadex I like to start a cycle with Novadex just to cover bases until I know where my estrogen is going to be sitting.
Okay.
And then, you know, if I'm just running a particularly generally a low level test based cycle of when I used to, I would put in Novadex as par course.
Okay.
And then when I knew my estrogen levels were starting to stabilize, then I'd have a look and say, right, what estrogen management do I need?
Interesting. Okay.
And then I'd adjust my estrogen management just so I had something in there to stop gyno and to have some form of inobtrusive estrogen management, so I could then see where my estrogen was sitting in relation to my dose, and then I could formulate a more targeted estrogen management plan.
Okay.
And that might then be, well, I'm going to go on to Aromacin and I drop the Novadex, or it might end up being a combination of two if I felt that there was need for. So there was various reasons behind what then went into my estrogen management.
Okay.
But yeah, people go on about, you know, well, long term it caused this, it's caused that. Yeah, but you're talking about cancer patients that are running these drugs for 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
You're not talking about a bodybuilder that's running it for 8, 12 weeks.
And that's kind of what I was getting at too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you've got to, studies are great, but you've got to step back from the study and look at it in its context.
Yeah.
You can't take a side effect from a drug in a study and then wholesale apply it to any use of that drug. Because dose is dependent and duration is very dependent. So you've got to look at the full context. You know, how much were they using? How long were they using it for? Is that relatable?
Yeah.
In the same way as you get all this, you know, the amount of times I've seen TRT studies pushed as positivity about using high dose test. And it's like, well, look, it improved their health. It did this, it improved them. I said, yeah, at a TRT dose. But you're talking about running 10 times that.
Yeah.
You know, the effect changes.
What do you think about Masteron for estrogen control? I think we may have spoke about this one point before. Somebody just recently asked me about this on Instagram stories. I said, I don't believe in it for estrogen control. It's not what I would use as my AI. Somebody else messaged me back though, saying, hey, I've gone on cycles using a gram of test, and he said he didn't aromatize much to begin with. And he was like, and I used Masteron, and that's all I needed.
Is that all he needed because he checked his bloods, or was that all he needed because he didn't get any symptoms?
Knowing this guy, he's a coach. He's a meticulous person. I'm going to believe that he checked his bloods.
Right.
Yeah.
I've seen it be useful.
Yeah.
The first problem with Masteron is getting real Masteron.
Yeah.
It is a commonly fake drug because it is a more expensive raw. But yes, it has some genuine anti-estrogen properties. I wouldn't say that it would be something I would rely on from my estrogen management, but I think at the lower end of test doses, if your aromatization isn't too crazy, then it would potentially be enough.
Okay.
But the only way you're going to know is by testing your blood. Hmm. You know, the only way you're going to know it. I mean, I had someone come in this week whose estrogen was 600.
Whoa.
Now, that's UK. So bear in mind, we're on PMOL. We're not on US standards.
What does your standard go up to, 300 or something?
149, I think it is.
Okay, 149. So still 600. So
still incredibly crazy. High.
Yeah.
No symptoms. No symptoms.
Dude, I've had that too. Very high estrogen. I was like, huh, something doesn't feel right. My libido feels a little bit off. Wonder what my blood work is. My estrogen was 300 on a scale that was supposed to go to 30.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I guess I got to manage this shit.
But they, what made his look was he had a slight dip in his libido.
That's what I experienced too.
A slight dip.
It was a little off.
Yeah. It's just phenomenal.
Where you think, I mean, for another guy, that might be like straight up man boobs now. You're done. You got man boobs.
I was speaking to a medical practitioner who deals a lot with testing of bodybuilders. He runs a bit of a drop-in center.
Okay.
So he offers subsidized testing for bodybuilders. For steroid users. And his general rule of thumb is anything over 200, you're at risk from gyno.
Mm. Yeah.
In a UK standard, which would be, relate that to America, would be anything over 45.
Wow. Wow. Anything over 45 in a US standard would be, that's pretty crazy. Because like I said, I was at like 300.
Yeah. So it's the range of sensitivities is quite surprising.
I think that I've changed too, because I think that earlier on, excuse me, we'll say even like a decade ago, I feel like I was a lot more sensitive to estrogen than I am now. Have you experienced that in your own life, or talked to guys that as they've aged, their sensitivity has changed? Because I feel like my sensitivity to androgens has changed too. Like the first time I ran Tren, I was like tense all the time, you know. And then now I've used Tren contest prep. I mean, I had used 2015, I want to say, I think I used as much as 100 milligrams every day, which was, I wouldn't suggest anybody on the show doing that. No, I think it was way above what you need.
Yeah, that's a decent whack as well.
But I was like, yeah, I'm just running Tren and Master Run and Test and throwing some Halo and Weenie. You know, it's like, and I'm just like going about life. Whereas earlier on, I had a lot harder time managing that. And I know there's been times like, man, earlier on I'd get sensitivity just from like 20 milligrams of D-ball, you know?
I think the older you get, and particularly when you start getting into your back end years, you do see definitely down a decrease in sensitivity. I mean, this person I'm thinking of was on the more mature end.
Are you saying, Dave, that I'm on my back end years now? Is that what you're telling me?
You're fucked, mate, to be fair. But I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want to upset you.
Fuck.
In fact, I think you're actually above me on Deadpool now.
We'll see. Hey, guys, let's start a Deadpool here on the YouTube page. You can comment below.
I'm already rating very high on several Deadpools. I don't need to be on anymore.
I voted for you. I
have actually had mates message me and say that I've cost them money because I haven't died yet.
Oh, that's hurts, man. That's rough.
It's like, thanks, guys. Well, we thought you'd be dead 5 years ago.
Oh, jeez.
I'm sorry to disappoint.
Yeah.
In fact, I get it on my channel now and again. I'll get a comment now and again that will pop up and say, oh, are you still alive? I thought you'd be dead by now.
That's good.
Yeah, you can't blame people for thinking that.
Dude, you pushed it so far, man. UC2 at 415 pounds, you were close, I think. You know, you were closer to that than not, you know.
Oh, no. I mean, if I had continued.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. I would have. If I wasn't dead by now, I would not be a very well bunny. I mean, as we know, I've got health problems anyway, but they're not overly impacting on my life. Touch wood. Yeah. Anyway, I've lost 28 pounds.
Holy crap. No kidding, man. That's good. Did you just give me that? What I thought you guys did that.
Whatever. I'm universal.
All right, let's see here.
I'm international.
You got another question for drugs and stuff. I'm not sure about this one. Maybe we should have kept Victoria on for this question. I don't know. We'll see what you have to say, Dave. He says, so I've read that higher androgens in the body leads to a lower uptake of lipids. Is it a lower uptake of dietary fat consumed or a lower uptake, meaning less food in general is turned into adipose tissue? If that is the case, would it not make sense to keep dietary fats higher on an enhanced cut since more of them are used for energy anyways?
Okay.
I don't know either. I need clarification on this one.
Well, fats aren't used for energy, particularly if you're in a carb-based diet. So fats are mainly used for hormonal function and enzyme production and some other bits and bats. So really, the uptake of lipids, well, one of the things is obviously you're not using lipids for the production of, you're not using cholesterol for the production of
testosterone, you know, yeah.
So if you're on gear, you're not going to be using that. Does being on cycle change the storage? I honestly don't know. I've never actually looked at it. But if I was to hazard a guess, I'd say yes.
Mm.
I would suspect yes, because we do know that obviously hormone fluctuations and increase in testosterone levels does change fat levels. So I'd say yes, but I don't see the reasoning behind why you would then want to run a higher fat diet. That bit I don't understand. It doesn't make sense though, to me.
Yeah, I feel like there's some type of missing link in there. I'm not sure either. I had a couple more questions, so we'll just go to them. One of them was about employing Tren in the off season. What are your thoughts there?
What are we employing it to do?
We're employing it to grow some muscle.
Oh, okay.
In the off season. What are your thoughts over on that, Dave? I'm going to see if I can pull
this a million times.
Yeah.
The biggest issue is off season, you want to grow. If you need to grow, you need to be fit and healthy. If Tren affects you in a negative way, I lack of appetite, lack of sleep, or any of those things associated with Tren use, then it's not something you really want to be looking at as an off-season compound.
Yeah.
If it doesn't affect you in those ways and you have a good appetite and you sleep well on it, then, yeah, okay, I can understand why you might choose it as a drug to use off-season. But if it's affecting sleep, it's affecting recovery, it's overstressing your body, or it's damaging your digestive ability, then why would you go near it?
Yeah, that was my thought, man. You want to feel happy, you want to feel good, be able to eat food, get good sleep.
You know, if you take EQ and say, fuck me, I feel like shit on EQ.
Yeah.
You wouldn't use it.
Yeah.
But when people discuss Tren for some reason, even if they feel like shit on it, they seem to think that because it's Tren, it's justification to use.
Yeah.
You don't need to feel like shit on your cycle. There's certain things when you're growing and certain things you can't avoid. Pain is one of them. You know, the increased weight is another one of them and everything that comes with that, feeling uncomfortable, feeling fatigued and all the rest of it. But, you know, if your drug cycle is making you feel like absolute arse, then you need to rework your drug cycle.
Yeah.
But for some reason, when we start talking about Tren, people accept feeling like absolute shit because it's Tren, and I don't understand that. If a compound makes me feel like arse, then I would not use that compound if I could.
Okay, how about if you feel good on Tren? Let's say, because I've talked to guys that are like, oh man, I don't get any of that. I just feel strong as fuck, and I feel aggressive in the gym. I love it.
But then there's good argument to use it.
Okay.
If you're not suffering the negativity of it, then there's good argument to use it.
Would you say that it would rate highly for an off season?
It's a hugely anabolic compound.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's the only thing I'd be concerned about is potentially you know, the you may have to monitor the period of time you're on it for.
Okay.
But I mean, we've discussed this in the past about drug cycles. When you start feeling shitty, when progress stops, when niggles start to occur all the time, that's when you really need to start be thinking, well, maybe I should be coming off.
Yeah.
It might be 3 weeks before you're due to come off, but that's your body saying enough's enough. I need a break.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just about listening to what your body tells you and adapting to it accordingly. So, you know, is trying a good off-season drug for most people? Probably not. But for some people, if they can tolerate it well and get along with it well and it creates progress, then crack on.
Okay. Tips on staying regular. We've got a couple of them here. Tips on staying regular on PrEP without using and abusing laxatives. I said my suggestions were increase water intake, dietary fiber. And with dietary fiber, you have to increase water intake.
Yeah. Prunes.
Prunes?
Prunes.
What are the there's got to be carbs in them, right?
Well, they're a very sugary fruit, actually, a prune. So okay.
So maybe not.
They've got a reputation for giving you the shits, which is why I said prunes.
Have you seen that, like, they have a tea, like the Smooth Move tea? It's all herbal teas. Those things, I've had clients use those work well.
Yeah, even some of the stuff, like, I don't know if you have the same, but we have one called Duck or Ease over here, yes, which softens your stool and yeah, stuff like that.
Now, that's a drug, right?
Yeah, but it's an OTC.
It's a mild yeah, one. If I could get away with not using those, I would, but that would be a route to go, I think.
You could stick with fiber if you're really struggling. You can get some fiber. High-dose vitamin C is going to get you moving as well. Fibrous veg. And probably just making sure that your diet's a bit varied.
Yeah.
Not sticking to the same source. And you know, not just eating potatoes and rice every day or you know, potatoes and chicken every day, should I say.
Which is hard to do, you know, when you're getting closer to the prep. You know, like when you're getting close to your show date. So but you know, you work on it, you get through. All right. Our connection's breaking up a little bit here, I think. I think Mrs. Crossland must be downloading something on Netflix right now.
That'll be my daughter.
Yeah? All right. Let's see here.
She'll have finished her homeschooling, so she'll be upstairs online.
Top three supplements that you must have at your house at all times.
Test, Deca, Oxy. That's it. OTC, I would say creatine. For most people, probably a protein powder is going to be very, very useful.
Okay.
A protein powder I don't feel is necessary. It's more a convenience food.
Sure, sure.
I think you can, for most people, comfortably get your protein requirements from it, and you don't need a protein powder, but it is a very convenient way of getting protein in for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Vitamin C is a very, very useful vitamin, particularly if you are a user. I like GDAs.
Yeah.
I think GDAs have a very positive impact beyond that, there's a sort of level there. Supplements, yeah, they're all right, and if you've got the money, throw them in, but I wouldn't be crucial on them.
Yeah. You know what I've been into nowadays is I started using this stuff. It's an electrolyte powder, and I'll use one serving of that pre-workout along with one serving of trace mineral. Well, it's a good hefty serving of trace minerals. I'll put that in with my pre-workout, and I find that it improves my contractility. I always get good workouts when I use it. You know, sometimes my hydration plays such a critical role in my training. I realize, you know, I mean, obviously it plays a role in your, in how well you can contract your muscles and how much strength you have, all that stuff. If I'm on top of my game with hydration, my workout is always going to be better. And having those minerals in there and having those electrolytes, it's like it ensures that I always have consistently good workouts. So that's become a big combo for me. And then the new one that I've really been into this last year has been vitamin D3. And I get the D with the K in it. And if you're a steroid user or if you're just on TRT, you deplete your resources of vitamin D. So your D is, mm-hmm. even if you live in a sunny area, even if you guys down there in Florida, California, even if you get enough sun, your levels can be lower, even if you're out there, you know, absorbing it. So that's one thing that I've been really into. And then, you know what I started during the quarantine, Dave, was vitamin A. I started vitamin A because it, in combo with vitamin D, was supposed to be good for your immune system. And I thought to myself, like, I wanted to boost up in case this whole thing was really bad. But I found that it improved my skin quality. Like, I could see it within like a few weeks that my skin started looking better. And that tells me I probably needed it, you know? So I'm keeping that in the regimen. Now, I know those things aren't bodybuilding related, but I guess they kind of are, you know, but they're more like base health supplements. But I mean, I guess that all ties in.
Yeah.
Be healthy, you're going to be better at the sport, right?
Yeah. No, vitamin A, I was going to say, when you said vitamin A, have you noticed a change in your skin? Because that's primarily what vitamin A is used for, is to improve skin quality.
Yeah, it's made a difference.
If you're a cheap ass and you don't want to spend money on electrolyte powder, salt water.
Well, this is good because the electrolytes has potassium, magnesium, and so. But yeah, absolutely. You know, you could add salt to your pre-workout meals and stuff like that too, right? Mm.
I often put clients on a teaspoon of salt in a glass of water pre-workout.
Really? Yeah. Mm. I've used it in my intro.
It can be that, and even also you could have a spoonful of sugar as well.
Okay. Yeah.
That's an old cheap ass bodybuilding trick as a base electrolyte formula.
Yeah.
So what some people used to do was it'd be salt water with a sugary cordial, so a sugary dilute.
Okay.
Or you could just literally put a spoonful of sugar and a spoonful of salt in a glass of water, stir it right up and get it neck down. Huh. Not the most pleasant tasting thing, I admit, but you'll get good pumps off that.
I like that idea. Yeah, that's a good one. All right, listen, let's get out of here. We'll let your daughter continue to search YouTube. Maybe she's watching your movie right now. Maybe she's no. No? What does she think about your movie?
Call of Duty. She's never. I don't think she's even watched it.
All right, but she plays games, huh? She's a gamer.
Yeah, she's a bit. I wouldn't say she's a big gamer. She's not a gamer on like a nerdy level gamer, but she enjoys the games. Yes, so. She got a recent Call of Duty, but I think it's an older one.
Well,
so she's probably playing that.
Well, in that case, we'll get out of here. We'll free up her bandwidth so that she can get some good headshots. And for another episode of Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland, head on over to crosslands.org.uk. Check out our great sponsors, truenutrition.com, getassoff.com. Guys, on the live feed, thanks for watching. Everybody else, we'll see you soon. Thanks, Dave.
Take care now. Bye-bye.